Now that which is twisted cannot be made right, nor that which is lacking be brought to the light. I spoke with my heart, saying, though I be wise, with knowledge surpassing Jerusalem's guise, my heart may to wisdom still more be applied, and madness and folly may vainly be tried. By wisdom a plenty, abundance of pains, one increases sorrow as his knowledge gains. That was Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 17 and 18 in context of the previous two verses. And it should be noted that even though this version is from 2004, there's a modification that was noted in August of 2011 by yours truly for this chapter of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. And that's the end of chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes. That's today's proverb. Little children. Now returning to chapter 1 of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. Paragraph 2 from the Genealogy of the Deluge, dated 3282 BCE. We have become more and more convinced of this date, 3282 BCE, and the difference between the deluge, 3282, and the founding of Solomon's Temple, 1014, is that number, 63 times 36, which is 2268, which is a recurring number in the genealogy, because it's also the time from Adam to the deluge, exactly 2268 years. It's quite a divine number because, of course, the number 63 also has the factor of 7 in it as well. It's and we also have, from the time of the founding of Solomon's Temple in 1014, 2268 years to 1255 CE, which is the birth of a particular important ancestor of the Habsburgs. So, and the existence of the ark structure as petrified wood in Turkey in the mountains of Ararat in Turkey confirms both the Bible account of the location, which mentions the mountains of Ararat specifically in the Bible. In the account of the deluge, it says that that was where the Ark of Noah came to rest, was in the mountains of Ararat. And everyone can look that up on their own, do their own research. But for some people, of course, there's been a misconception for many years that it was on Mount Ararat, which is one particular mountain upon which the ark did not land. Although people continue to search every year and go marching on an expedition up Mount Ararat to continue to search vainly for Noah's ark. But we know that when we look at this evidence that's been presented, the ark was hidden for some time by mud or whatever, and then it flowed down. The mud flows brought the ark down the mountain and uncovered it in recent times. So it was discovered sometime, I believe, I heard recently. It's in the article somewhere, we talk about it. I think it was in the 50s. When the Darupanar site was discovered by an aerial survey done by the military of some country flying over. I guess it would probably be the Turkish military. But they were able to identify this boat-like shape from their aerial surveillance, and that's how the Ark was discovered in about the 50s, I think it was, and then, you know, the 1950s. And when they discovered that, that's when the interest began, you know, in investigating this Darupanar site, which is near Uzengili, which is also not quite so near to Dogu Bayazit, the big city in Turkey. So the Bible account is confirmed. That's the incredible thing. That alone should tell us, well, this has got to be Noah's Ark, because it's in the place where the Bible said it would be. It's got to be where it is. It's got to be the right thing. It has to be Noah's Ark. But, you know, but then, of course, if nothing else were correct about it, that wouldn't make it Noah's Ark. But the fact that the exact dimensions given in the Bible, you know, when you account for the number phi as being the average, you know, to get the average width, you divide the beam width by the number phi. And by the way, there's this incredible property. Phi is an amazing number. There's another property of the number phi, okay? This 1.618, see if I can remember what it was, 618-033-98875. Was that the right number? That's just from my memory. 1.618-033-98875. Okay. Now we square that. What do we get? 2.618-033-98875. 2.618. So squaring phi gives you 1 plus phi, as well as the fact that when you divide 1 divided by phi, you get phi minus 1. So the incredible properties of that number, it's just mind-boggling. There's no other numbers like that. You can't cube it. You can't say phi cubed. That doesn't work. I mean, you know, you can't say phi cubed is going to be 3.618. It's not. It's 4.236, etc. So this number has this incredible number phi. It's unbelievable, the properties of that number. So it's not surprising that it was used in the construction of the ark, so that the beam width was 100 and whatever it was, 138 feet, I think it was. And so when you divided that by phi and then converted it to Egyptian cubits, you got 50 for the average width. It worked out very accurately. So that was what the Bible said it was, 50. So the length was exactly right. And the width had to be adjusted, because no boat is a rectangle. It had to be a beam width with a tapering bow and stern dimension. So you had to get an average width using the number phi, which we just explained. And then the depth would be, you could have taken an average depth, I suppose, too, but the depth was not measurable anyway on the actual wreck of the ark. Let's call it the wreck, I guess, but it wasn't a wreck. It was a wreck only after it came down the mountain and hit a rock outcropping. Then it became a wreck. It was never wrecked while it was in service, but the Bible account is confirmed by the fact of where it was found. That in itself proves not only the identity of the boat, but it also proves that the Bible is true. That's why people are so loath to accept any of this, because they're only too aware that if they accept any of this as being factual, then they'll have to accept the Bible as being factual. And they've already entrenched themselves, many of them, in behavior and beliefs that are against the Bible completely. So they have no way that they can ever get back to believing that any of the Bible is true. They're just not willing to look at it. And there's another strange thing also that happens, that someone also, we all are like this, we all think this way, but we also think if someone's wrong in one thing, then they're also wrong in everything else. Just like we think if someone's right in one thing, well, then they're probably right in everything else too, right? So there's all these human tendencies that are characteristics of humans who are not perfect, right? But the proliferation, okay, the other proof of this, right, The petrified wood, too, proves that it was a long time ago, right, when this ship was first located or landed on that particular mountain near Yüzengili in Turkey. But it was a very ancient event based on the fossilization of the wood. And now we're going to talk about some other things, for example, that are proof of the deluge. For example, the proliferation of fossils in a widely distributed layer. Like, that means widely over the whole entire Earth, throughout all the lands on Earth, can only encourage all believers that all of these animals died suddenly in the deluge. You know, why else would they be the same conditions everywhere, you know, in all the lands all over the earth at the same time? But not only that, of course, but also the fossils were formed rapidly. And that we know because dead animals do not sink to the bottom. They float, right? I mean, that's known. And so all the sediment would have had to have been dumped on the animals all at one particular moment in time so that the animals wouldn't be able to float to the surface. Nor are fossils formed by gradual soil deposits caused by erosion. So not only do animals not sink to the bottom when they die, but also you don't get fossils formed by gradual soil deposits, like 0.5 millimeter every 10 years or whatever they're claiming it is. It's some small amount. These animals would be scavenged and eroded and, you know, broken apart by the elements and by weathering. And but, you know, there'd be no remnant left to form a fossil of an entire animal. Just wouldn't happen. So the idea of fossil formation is completely based on some kind of ridiculous notion, you know, about how fossils are formed. And yet everybody in the scientific world at large has gone along with it and accepted that fossils are formed in that ridiculous, nonsensical way that they claim they're formed, which is nonsense, obviously. Animals, in another situation, in the north, for example, where it was cold, animals were frozen in water with gut contents, their stomach contents, preserved. So they'd eaten something, they didn't even have time to digest it, and they were completely engulfed in water and frozen all at the same time. So it was cold enough in the north, of course, for that to happen, but all of a sudden the water had to arrive in a huge deluge in order for that to happen. And that was found. They did find animals like that with their guts, the contents of their gut, completely preserved. They have, you know, documented evidence of that. There are actually flood accounts in different cultures. We talked about that already. And from places located as far apart as America and China. So far apart, like the opposite side of the world. They both talk about these worldwide flood or this massive flood that, or this destructive flood that, you know, basically was, you know, had all these characteristics. Let's see if we can find the China one here. In the list, let's see, Sumatra, Brazil, Peru, the Cree, the Cherokee. There's China. Yeah. So in China, the myth was the destruction occurred. There was a destruction by water. Human seed was saved, and animal seed was saved. Animal animal kind, in other words, their seed, the seed of the animals, the young of the animals. It could mean that, in other words, the ability to reproduce, in other words, was preserved, right, for the animals and the humans. And the birds were sent out in China also, mentions in the Chinese version of the deluge. So that's very noteworthy, isn't it? Now, you know, not all the flood legends, very few of them claimed it was a universal destruction, but that's okay. It still is amazing that there are flood legends throughout the world like that, including China and North America, which are so far apart as to be impossible, you know, with regard to having been two separate events so far apart. I mean, not when they talked about the same essential elements, right? The fact that humans were saved. And we know that there's the Chinese legend of the eight immortals, right? These are the ones who survived, apparently, according to that. I'm not an expert on Chinese mythology or anything, or any of that, because there's just too many cultures to try and study all of them. It's impossible to become expert on everything. So, but if I get interested in that, I'll research that some more, you know, that kind of thing. But it looks like from the drawing of the eight immortals, they're portrayed as being on water, you know, they're traveling on water. And why they're called immortals would appear to be because they survive. That's why they're immortal, right? They didn't die when this deluge came. And there are many convoluted stories about, you know, about the deluge itself, or the stories that would be very consistent with that story of the deluge, which is explained only really truthfully in the Bible, in all of its accurate details with dates and so on. It is vain. Okay, we've got to go back up, look at some of this. All of these facts testify that a global deluge came true. The Bronze Age is dated after the deluge, near 3300 BCE, and was not the first time that man employed metalworking. From the genealogy, okay, so about 3300, that's when the Bronze Age is dated. You know, they date the Bronze Age, 3300. But we don't believe that, even though that's the first time when metalworking was used after the deluge, was about 3300, because the deluge was 3282. So that the deluge date in our chronology is perfectly consistent with the Bronze Age, starting right after that. But we know there was metalworking prior to the deluge also, of course. But there's only an 18-year difference between 3300 and 3282. It is vain to believe dating based on a human reasoning. In any case, where the lack of written records exerts silence. So, yeah, we can't really believe the fact about about the Bronze Age being dated exactly 3300, for example. If there aren't any written records about the Bronze Age, it's just an estimate. But the written records are so crucial to all of this. That's why the Bible is so much superior to everything else with regard to the scientific theories of the, for example, evolution is a scientific theory that is completely without documentation or any proof or reproducibility of any kind. You know, species transmutation is not demonstrable. The futility of using human wisdom to determine even small subtleties with regard to the deluge is exemplified by the remains. It's given as an example, right, or it's made into an example by the remains. That's what exemplified means. By the remains of Noah's wife, because her remains were found in an 18-foot-long sarcophagus. And these are things that are so secret, you know, so poorly known, you know, so well hidden, let's say, and so hard to believe, and so hard to find anywhere in any research or in any writings, that it's even hard to be able to find any of it or present it. You know, it's difficult to even write this. When I wrote this, it's difficult to write because there's so little evidence of any of this. But if Noah's wife was 18 feet tall, then Noah was also, you know, he was tall also. But they were both tall, is the idea of this, and that they were giants, essentially, just like some of the creatures or beings in the Bible were said to be giants because of the angels having come down and interbred with the sons of men, remember? If you've not seen that in the book of in the book of Genesis, it mentions that just prior to the deluge account. In the account of Genesis, it mentions the Nephilim, these giants that were the product of the interbreeding of angels with men, or human women. See, the word man means the same thing as a woman is just a female man. So the word man, there's nothing gender specific about the word man. At least one meaning of the word man just means human. So when it says, you know, well, they interbred with the daughters of men, but you could say they interbred with humans or with men. It's the same thing. But the angels interbreeding with humans is what created giants. So Noah and his wife, it seems from this, actually were giants, but we're not going into that in great detail. But it is a great honor to be given a glimpse into this past, isn't it? To actually have any glimpsing of it is so there's a word I was trying to think of there. Poignant. It's poignant. It has this incredible, like, we never hear about most of these things most of the time. So it's so divinely, you know, appreciated, and or so deeply felt when we hear about these things, but yet in a way that is almost you know, mysterious and almost hard to define. It is hard to define, but it's almost subtle in the way it causes us to feel. The genealogy dating has been tested and proven already. Now, if you discover these things for yourselves, you'll be just as excited as I was when I discovered these things on my own through my own research, digging and eventually finding. That's far more satisfying and rewarding. And our chronology, the genealogy, has been proven, right, so many ways. Even at the time of this article, which I've already given as dating to 2010. So even in that year, 2010, we'd already proven the chronology. The genealogy is the name of it. The blessed genealogy, we call it. The BG. But it had been proven long before this article was written, or at least long before, not in time, but long before in terms of work. So in this article, may confirmation no longer be required, even at the time of this article, for the genealogy. We didn't even require confirmation for the date of the deluge at this time. It was already known. let's see what we can do now with the with the movie again. We're starting here at 11 minutes. See how far we can get before we get an ad. Let me change this size of my head here. Let's see what we can do. We've got a couple of minutes here.
All day long, two hands were required at a time to hold the steering oar in position. But as we got to know the raft and its characteristics, we discovered that all we needed to do was to lash the helm and the raft would steer itself. After this, we had no major problems in handling the Kon-Tiki, as long as the weather was stable. From now on, it was the duty of the man at the helm to keep an eye on the lashings and to make the necessary adjustment if there was a change of the wind, so that our raft at all times presented her stern to wind and wave. We had a female on board. Her name was Lorita, and she was a South American parrot. The first few days, Lorita, in common with one member of the crew, was seasick. But after 4 days, both of them were excellent sailors. Chipping a little water makes no difference, as it all runs out through the gaps between the logs. The advantage of a raft is simply that water pours out just as quickly as it pours in. We had to make sure that the raft always presented her stern to the wind. If we lay a beam to the wind, our bamboo hut would be awash. As long as the sail filled with a following wind, the raft would ride the waves and float like a cork. Failure to react with the steering oar when the wind backed or veered would result in the square sail jibbing. We'd then have to work the heavy steering oar and wrestle with the sail to bring the raft back on course. Otherwise, the sail would flap violently against the bamboo hut. At night, we were always lashed down to prevent being knocked overboard by the sail. The logs were always slippery, and we had no guardrail, and there'd nearly always be a shark following in our wake. In the end, the Kon-Tiki would gracefully submit and continue calmly her way with the wind astern. She never made any attempt to turn back. On the contrary, should she do a right-about turn, she would continue on her course backwards. There was never a day when the wind veered right round and blew from dead ahead. It always came from the continent astern as it swept across the Pacific. This is how we determined our speed and the distance covered over the water. One of the crew perches in the bows and drops a piece of balsa wood overboard. We know the overall length of our raft, and a crewman in the stern times the piece of balsa wood as it floats past. In this way, we can, with a fair degree of accuracy, determine our speed through the water. Hesselberg would take sun shots with his sextant, and in this way, we could mark our position on the chart as we drifted across the ocean. From the top of the mast, we could look down on the starboard side of the raft where the hut was open, and where we spent most of our time. This was also the galley, which consisted of a wood crate with a primus stove inside, on which we did our best to make meals the European way. After all, we were not Incas. Besides, we were keen to show how seaworthy our raft was. Occasionally, when the Kon-Tiki rolled unduly, the wood crate would catch fire. And on one occasion, when the cook had dozed off, the actual wall of the bamboo hut caught fire. Fortunately, water was always readily available on board, and a fire could be put out very quickly. If we got a bit bored with one another's company, we could always paddle off in the rubber dinghy and observe our comrades at a distance. The first time we did this, we failed to realize that getting back to the Kon-Tiki would be a problem, as the raft moved at such a speed that with our small paddles we couldn't catch up, nor could the men on the Kon-Tiki reduce speed, much less come about and back against the wind. Even after the sail had been lowered, the Kon-Tiki moved at a fair speed owing to the pressure of wind on the bamboo hut. As it turned out, we just managed to catch up on this occasion, and were completely exhausted by the time we were close enough to catch a rope that was thrown out. From that day, it was strictly forbidden to paddle off in the rubber dinghy without being secured to the Kon-Tiki by a long rope. It wouldn't have been much fun being left astern in the middle of the Pacific. The nearest land was endless miles away, and we never sighted a single ship in the entire course of our voyage. Our parrot had by now become a real seabird. If the wind freshened, she would entertain us with gymnastic displays on the stays. She would be highly offended if we tried to shut her in her cage inside the bamboo hut. After a month, the Contiki was way out in the ocean. The Humboldt current carried us north almost as far as the equator, after which we struck out straight across the Pacific. Ocean currents accounted for about one-third of our actual speed, and the rest was the gift of the trade wind.
So there we go. That's enough for today, I think, of our movie. It's the story of the Contiki. It's called Contiki from 1950, the movie of the expedition led by Thor Heyerdahl. And which sought to prove that it would have been possible for South Americans to build a boat and sail to Polynesia, even though the later genetic evidence was shown to prove that that was probably not what happened. They probably didn't do that, but still, Thor Heyerdahl had this idea, and he wanted to prove that it was possible. And then later, there were the two expeditions called Ra 1 and Ra 2, where he sought to prove that the Egyptians could have, or the Africans at least, or any of the, I think he was talking about the, it was named Ra, so obviously the Egyptians are involved somehow, but it's got to do with the sailing from Africa to Barbados, which was an expedition that he set out to achieve. And in the case of this first expedition, we'll find out what happens, whether they succeed also. But it was such an exciting series, and my dad loved it, and so it was a family event where we watched this, and very entertaining, especially in the later, it seems to me, maybe even more so in the later series, the Ra 1 and Ra 2. But that's it. They're spelled Ra as in R-A, the Egyptian sun god. That's it for today's study, little children. It is September 4th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 20:54 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty. This is Cassie. They're saying bye for now. We're studying the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express article from 2010, and that was Chapter 1, Paragraph 2.